CBD Revolution. The world is discovering CBD and its potential for numerous health benefits. Hemp Fusion Wellness is the premier company looking at CBD with a whole food perspective. For the highest quality CBD oils and products for stress, sleep, energy, and topicals, it's Hemp Fusion. This CBD Revolution highlight has been brought to you by Hemp Fusion Wellness, U.S. trading symbol CBDHF, and in Canada, CBD.U. Web address, hempfusion.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
Gordon Liddy is My Muse by Tommy Tip Payne, a novel by John Calvin Batchelor, read by John Batchelor. Hollywood before the mast. I meet Ahab. I get harpooned. 1. Tip's done TV enough to know that he's no good in the glass, which is show business talk for poor on camera. There's also Tip's opinion that he's done the Letterman show enough forever, and that the Today Morning Gang is yawning, which leaves him cranky with a conviction never to smell their caffeine breath again. Nevertheless, Johnny Carson's Tonight Show is moonwalking to sci-fi spy guys, and I blinked once and said yes twice when the booker called my Hollywood agency and they called me. Tonight wanted me right away, tomorrow night, to replace a Stalinist poet who was glasnost-bound in East Europe. Maybe some other combination. I was loafing and ice fishing at the time, up at my camp at Moosehead Lake. It was just after Christmas, when Maine's deep woods are white silence save for the wind and the occasional felonious snowmobiler. My solitary holiday had run its course. I'm a humbug about Christmas and happy for it. I was supposed to be starting and finishing a new romance of the Cold War. I write suddenly so as not to think about it. Besides, I've done all the research digestible, and the plots are buddies. Yet I was feeling too lazy to twist, assassinate, chase, rescue, ironize, and found myself keeping the fire too high and staring for many happy hours into another superb xenophobia game in my playmate, the Mac. Also, my imaginary best friend McCurr had been scheduled to show up so we could try one more time to teach me to ski at Squaw Mountain. But his Irish pirate boss had shanghaied him to go buccaneering again. Bluntly, I was catatonically Tip. For these slim warrants, I chose to exit my cozy burrow among black bears and go where I don't belong to get a hard lesson that love and madness are a tricky old couple who entertain bystanders the way hunting season amuses wildlife. Details follow, beginning with packing nothing since my tropical gear was in New York, ringing up the local motorcycle poacher gang I use as a limo service, and suffering a scary dawn ride over slick ice to Bangor for the hop and a half to L.A. and its choice neighborhood of make-believe, Hollywood. 2. I shall surprise you by declaring right away that I like Hollywood. It's been great to me. There are those other opinions, yes, but it's also true that anything that is said about Hollywood is true. Thievery, cokery, slavery, pre-Oedipal, creepy, rancid stew, etc. party line. As everyone's dearest press agent, Oscar Wilde, said of everyone's dearest humbug, George Bernard Shaw, you can say of Hollywood, it has no enemies, all its friends hate it, intimately. But not Tip Payne. And it's not just the demi-large checks Hollywood has issued me, nor that I get to stay in my agent's mother's Beverly Hills mansion when I go there, nor that I am demi-somebody there for 5 projects that got made. There are also several of my brilliant hack jobs stashed away like treasure maps, one of which here guides me to prize folly. None of this business is why. I like Hollywood because I understand what it is. It's New Bedford, Massachusetts, 1850. It's the square-masted whaling industry on the opposite coast. Take an illustration. Observe the vast Pacific out there. the naked mass of the whalers tied up in Santa Monica. Look closely at the proud financiers called Mr. Goodfellow Man and Ms. Goodlady Person, who wait on the quay to sign on another scabrous crew of dregs, children, and whiners, who, when sent before the mast a year or two, will mostly obey the rules, take every whale they can find, melt the blubber down into oil, then sail back to disgorge the bounty into the hands of the goods. The famous ships' names are in the Whaling Hall of Fame, my favorite of the Stalinist or Cold War flicks, King Kong, Hunchback of Notre Dame, John Ford's Corpus, Body Snatchers, Ben-Hur, 2001, Jaws, Aliens. You know them as if you'd sailed on them, and that's part of the humor. The audience gets harpooned and converted while loving its predator forever. Meanwhile, the goods are keeping their counting houses happy, or not, and are trying to convince the bankers to loan them enough to crew the same old ship with a new name, or not. The goods are very good, that is a fact. They are trustworthy, thrifty, pious taxpayers who live in great clabbered houses that smell pleasantly of plunder. Sometimes they form cartels like UA or Warner's or 20th Century, but only for tax purposes, because what they love best is to operate independently. It's called being an indie. Borrow the money, hire the ship, take the plunge into the deep green sea. As for the scabrous crew, they come and go, and it's Hollywood smarts to let them have some of the swag, most of the glory, and all of the blame. The first mates you know, too. My favorites, again, are the Stalinists and Cold Warriors, Sturgis, Hawks, Ford, Kubrick, Spielberg, from all ports and creeds. The harpoonists are obvious, studs like Brando, Brando, Brando. The twist is that the crew mostly behaves when at sea, and when in port it gains useful publicity for meaningless whale oil by being what it is, dregs, children, and whiners. Cocaine is their current rum and folly their bed. When not before the mast, they will eat, punch, drink, snort, beg, cheat, apologize to anything. Their fate is the same as flesh, mean, desperate, organic. It's not even their fate to bury, because if it's really silly, the goods will name a ship after them and go fishing. The two correct questions you should ask now are, who is Ahab? Where is Moby Dick? I could be smart alecky and reply that Captain Ahab is in his cabin, since he doesn't appear on deck until well at sea, when he once again gets to quote scripture to albatrosses and goes stupendously mad. I could also remark that the white whale is wherever you aren't looking. He's a confidant of Poseidon and, Ahab's opinion, a familiar of Hades. Yet, I must be accurate. Ahab is a major character in a fine book too many educated people ignore, and Moby Dick is a big, nasty white whale who doesn't exist. You have noticed in my salty illustration of Hollywood that I named no captains. This is deliberate. There are no captains. No one is in command. It's a business, not a quest. The truth is that there are no purposefully mad Ahabs, no worthily pursued white whales. Fortunately for me and other scriveners, the goods neither understand nor want to that Messrs. Ahab and Dick are make-believe. What this means is that they are always looking for that famous captain to go questing. It also means that the goods believe they need my kind of cartography to place in Ahab's hand when they find him, as if I possessed a secret chart to Moby Dick's patrol area in Whale Alley. It's the best reason why I like Hollywood. I get treated as if I know something it doesn't. Yes, the word is that the only folk lower than actors in Hollywood are the screenwriters, who aren't writers, thank goodness. And yes, this is true, until you are the one who makes money. I had not lost it three times, had made it modestly once, and was now netting it like a Russian trawler. It was why Mr. Johnny Carson's show had called me. The indie goods who owned my latest picture were flacking me as deserving of an Oscar the Harpoonist nomination for my recent work. In Hollywood, that post-Christmas season, in brief, Tip was better than hot. He was pre-hot. Thank you. Gordon Liddy is my muse. Hollywood before the mast. 3. I ambled out of the eucalyptus caverns of Los Angeles International Airport. It's called LAX on the baggage tags. Guess why? Still wearing my main woolens and wincing at the January heat like a seasoned fisher of persons. My Hollywood agent, Yakima Cohn, was thorough enough to send a limo to pick me up. He was further thorough to be inside talking on the phone. This is ancient history, pre-mobile days, no iPhones. Yaki delayed his administration quickly, put the receiver to his chest, began to me, "Slyboots, don't we look warm? Or are we calling attention to ourselves already?" I mumbled that I was dressed correctly for where my body still thought it was, Moosehead Lake. I added that I'd not had my tropicals and I figured I could let the local tailors rob me. Yaki was keener. "No, we're fabulously dressed for this. Don't touch a scratchy scratch, and the thing on your face will trim it a tad and shove you into the lights. They'll love it. Nanook, tonight!" We were so worried that this might catch the bunker on us if you went out there and started chatty Kathy. "You talk so well, but you have way too much to say, and it's always never very not Michigas. But Moosehead Lake!" "That's your statement. Moosehead Lake! Just tell me where you are. You didn't bring any antlers." I asked Yaki not to tease anymore. My stage fright was replacing my jet lag. It was noontime, and that meant no matter how I looked, I was due at The Tonight Show, Burbank Studio, 6 hours. "Antlers is giggles, Bambino," countered Yaki, "and aren't we the serious one? But all right, you're my baby, even if you do think too much. Relax now, it's my town and I'm doing business. Think putting." Yaki directed the chauffeur to drive safely while he continued his telephone administration to a colleague named Faisal. He also presented me with a good luck gift, a custom-built sandwich. This is Yaki's loving sense of humor. He is a first-rate human being who was mostly show business and the rest PGA groupie. His late father was a good fellow. His ceaselessly generous mother is a good widow. His sister is at a kibbutz. Being a psalm-singing socialist who's way too utopian for my research, and his best friend is a healthy money winner on the PGA circuit. However, the three details you notice right away about Yaki are none of the above. First, he is disabled. His eyeglasses are very thick because he's legally blind. His telephone right hand is pincer-like with 2 digits. He walks with crutches because both his legs, born ill-formed and weak, have been amputated below the knees. Secondly, he is so far out of the closet that even in Hollywood he is known as an unusually clear-cut person. Thirdly, he talks funny. His American is Beverly Hills, Yale drama, agent, golf. His Yiddish is stagecraft. His salesmanship is statecraft. In sum, I have the best agent on the planet. Yaki took me on when I was nobody but a baby salesman. He said he liked my lapidarian prose. And right away I was demi-somebody because Yaki was speaking for me at Kasai. The first time I met Yaki was back in 1979. He had stopped in New York en route to his latest nephew's birth in Israel via the British Open. I crept into the ludicrous Russian tea room and was escorted to his table. I was dumbstruck. He was on the phone, dressed like Yaki in tastefully happy cream and pastel layers, and wearing a Star of David on a small pearl necklace. I thought I might be in trouble, and tried to evaporate when he rose gracefully on his crutches and offered his hand to shake, his pincer-like hand. Yaki's opening line was, "What are we today?" I said I was Tip, dressed in Tip uniform, blazer and khakis, and I took him seriously. It turned out that he was more anxious at meeting me than I would have been at meeting Gordon Liddy. Yaki does not think me crazy about Gordon Liddy, by the way. He understands about the muse, parrot on the shoulder stuff. That first luncheon, Yaki became my friend and confidant forever, though I didn't know it. I thought him extraterrestrial. He turned out to be a primary Homo sapiens, what is called in Yiddish a mensch. If anything, I am the sly visitor from a Puritan galaxy. Further, I was never wrong-headed about homosexuality, just college boy ignorant. After a few years in New York City, I wised up. Take another illustration. Once upon a time, I was a boy and they were boys, and we didn't think about being more than boys. Soon, I discovered I liked girls intimately, and I've not been comfortable since. They discovered they liked boys intimately, and I've not been comfortable since, though, from my envious point of view, they seem much happier than Tip and have many more friends. The truth of equality is what Citizen Payne said, equal before the law, and a republic without lords or slaves. I translate this to America, in these anxious days, to mean that everyone gets a chance to be good or bad the same way. There's no reason to flack one group as more special than any other. This is Tip theory. Tip practice is that Tip the visitor from afar gets the best of the gender deal. Women and men regard him. He usually regards them, even the scoundrels. And it is Tip's unearned gift that he's always been regarded generously by the non-straight men he's met. Yaki I love like the older brother I don't have. Also, he's a wise gentleman. He's heard my palaver about Hollywood before the mast and has often opined generously. Whatever you say, Sly Boots, it's a business, show business. He also says he knows Ahab and Moby Dick are make-believe on paper. He's seen John Huston's smart version of Moby Dick 5 or 10 times, looking in on other peg-leg heroes like himself, and he has opined, that fabulous fat white fish steals every scene, and he's only on camera the last reel. The naughtiest scene stealer since Fay Wray thought she was the star. We rode the L.A. traffic jam without end into Beverly Hills. I don't know L.A. enough to describe driving around. There are many low points, a few hills, hilarious freeways. North is San Francisco. East is America. South is Mexico. Western is a kind of movie that used to make money. For those who make believe, the center of the world is Hollywood and Vine, and the bivouac is Beverly Hills. The trendy goods have scattered to other havens, and Beverly Hills is now chock full of mind and tooth doctors and widows, but it's still Hollywood's sentimental digs. Eventually, we arrived at Yaki's mother's tastefully cream and pastel palace, amid other palaces and gorgeous tropical flora and fauna. Soon enough, I was in some wing of the palace, shaving my beard off in the shower, nixing Nanook tonight before Yaki got tricky, when the phone rang. It's over the pastel toilet, of course, and within easy reach of the pastel jacuzzi. "What are we today?" started Yaki. I grunted. "Still serious. Less lava soap and more banana shampoo, tipster. Are you there?" I grunted again. Only my mother and Yaki call me tipster. "I have good bad and bad good for you," he said, just off the wire. "Good bad is that the Tonight Showmen do want you. Bad good is that they've delayed your tee off until Mundayana." I translated. With 4 hours to go, the Tonight Show had delayed my premiere. I felt much better instantly. Then I realized I was stuck with a weekend of stage fright in L.A. Yaki continued to soothe. He said that he liked my luck because now I could rest and get much less thoughtful. Also, he said, this meant I would be doing Tonight, not with Mr. Carson, whom Yaki adored but whom he thought a tad too serious for someone as serious as me. Rather, I would be out there with permanent guest host Jay Leno, whom Yaki adored and who he knew would bring out all the sweet warm colors in my black and white bibliographical brain. Great, I thought. I don't get to meet my hero, Mr. Johnny Carson. I get to chat with a guy my age whose jawline makes me feel as if I'm watching the Dudley Do-Right show. Was this good bad or bad good? I didn't know. It was what Yaki hates me to call his hometown, Never Never Land. Yaki accelerated to agent speed. I can hear you thinking, unless that shampoo in your eyes. Don't I treat you well? A sneak screening of Spielberg Tonight, which won't be awful, and loads of outtakes from Ben-Hur on Mom's Vid, and beautiful Beverly Hills REM sleep. And tomorrow, 18 holes at the club, and then a most polite party at the marina. I said that Ben-Hur outtakes were okay, but no parties. You'll love the marina, argued Yaki. The ocean moves, and we don't. You'll adore the music, Vivaldi and Telemann. And if you're well-behaved, I'll let you go to church on Sunday before more golf. Now, wipe out the shampoo and tell me you love it. I said that I was not here for love or money, just TV. My thinks he's a tough guy, said Yaki. Tell me you love me. Gordon Liddy is my muse. Hollywood before the mast. 4. Now comes Ahab, along with love and money, the three things I didn't want in L.A. coming at me like a harpoon. Ahab was not at the hyped-up screening of a new Steven Spielberg movie about, what else, Steven Spielberg making movies. Also, Ahab was not at Yaki's fantasy country club with its overlush but playable fantasy golf course. Yaki worships golf, though he cannot play, because he worships his best friend Billy Benn, who was away on Australian links that January. Where Ahab abided was at that promised most polite party at the marina, which was not a party but a charity benefit for the current fashion, L.A. street gang rehabilitation. I know I've also declared that Ahab is not, that he doesn't exist outside of paper, and neither does that fat, white fish, M. Dick. I'm not trying to trick you any more than I tricked me. This is a salty Hollywood yarn, and as the spectacular former swabby President Reagan has said often, it's all smoke and mirrors. Well, Ahab smokes naturally, and he lives in my looking glass. Here he comes, after some details, and the first trick is that this time around, he's very female. The marina was at Santa Monica Sunset. The crowd on the enclosed deck was as polite as charity can afford. So many goods that the scabrous crew members looked intimidated away from their usual vandalism. Of note instantly was that it was a very A-list male gathering. You want names? You don't know the goods to hear them. That's the secret of their authority. Power makes privacy. The public studs included Michael, Bobby, Bruce, Tom, Jeff, Tom, Don, Kevin. I'm teasing. My idol, Tom Selleck, wasn't there. You think these studs of Hollywood street gangs don't party together? You're correct. This wasn't a party. It was a benefit, and the boys were present for self-benefit. You call it winter, but in Hollywood it's called Oscar season. The marina gathering to Vivaldi and Telemann strings might raise money for crack hooligans, but it was definitely a test for screen hooligans to see who was most polite enough. Now, to risk nominating, maybe next year, and who this year could be trusted to open the envelopes on camera. The acceptable openers and winners have passed this test and moved on to other polite games, like endorsing presidents. Yaki hadn't told me. Well, the most polite had been a soft clue. But this was a showbiz, A-list, male, pre-hot, close-set tryout. The bonding was why I was unprepared for Kate's. That's both names together, Mrs. Kate O'Cates. Her imaginative foes call her the K.O. word, and her hired friends say, "Yes, ma'am," instantly. She was no star or director. She was an independent producer, one of the goods. I was complaining to Yaki about the fit of my blazer out of the club pro shop and communicating how long I was not staying, 15 minutes, no more. And he was bartering. "Give me 24, tipster." Even a sitcom gets 24, when Kate stalked upon us and began fishing. "I'm lucky to find you at last, Mr. Payne," she said, taking my hand strongly to shake it cleanly. Correctly, she didn't finish the salutation and name herself. The goods assume you know them. If not, you're worthless. Also correctly, she used the first-person plural when she was doing business. "We've called Yaki about you several times," she said. "And he's told us you hide out in the Arctic, Hudson's Bay. No phone, no TV, no roads, no show." Flustered, I mumbled, "Call me Tip." Yaki propped a crutch against me, whispered her name to me like Dread, oh Dread, and addressed Cates, sounding defense-minded. I sent in a dog team, Cates. He's here to breakfast with Mom and play golf with me. Oh, Yaki, I like your mysteries. Cates grinned very toothily, like an owner of all secrets. I won't skip ahead, she said. But I think we'll keep the tape machine rolling. Say, Late Night Network? I've never seen you in the glass, Mr. Payne. And it's good to see you first. The glass is cramped for tall, dark, and deep men. She gestured toward the Hollywood studs glowing behind her, all of them low on the horizon like cunning photo reductions of the sunset. Don't you agree? It's a small mystery why it likes small and cute. You must know. This was a stealthily easy question, and this fool went for it, jesting. Who'd want a big jester? As a reward, I didn't get a fish hook. I got her cool fingers on my wrist. You don't wear a timepiece, said Cates, changing bearings. A pro's pro. Is that because you don't care, like they say? Or do you have chronophobia, like my son? He was a month late, and I'm still waiting for him to tell me to get off his case, same as his father did, behind schedule. She paused, as if she'd confessed. Her self-deprecation glowed like virtue. But now you're here, and it's our time to talk, yes? Detail, all details, chronophobia. Nice detail, Cates, and a tough clue. Cates was a detail person. I argue it was why I liked her so quickly. Sure, there was the detail that she was easy-looking, tall, fair, and deep. Streaked hair, eyes any color, contact lens she chooses, original long limbs, hired-on deltoid broad shoulders, and coiled legs. She was heavier than fashion or camera permits. Much later, she told me that in her college days, she'd tried screen acting, but that she was no good in the glass. She said that two children, divorce, and too much sport had made her, at 41, a pumped-up jockette. What you noticed first and only about that pretty face was the teeth. They were whalebone white, and they didn't quit. They just kept coming at you. She talked and fed omnivorously, and she was snacking from a heap plate of fat California vegetables and tardy dip as she did business. Meanwhile, Yaki was still fending her off. We just stopped by on the way from the clubhouse. Some free giggles and home for Betty Bye. Get in 36 holes tomorrow if I can keep him from church. Sensational to see you, Cates. You look sensational, and when Tipster's back in town, we'll have lunch on your boat. Got one yet? Yaki yanked a brass button on my coat sleeve. Cates did not wait. This is now, Yaki. I want a meeting. She fixed dead ahead on me. The white teeth snapped on a carrot and me together. We admire your work, Crunch, and want to work with you, Crunch, you, Mr. Payne. I mumbled, please, call me Tip, please. We mean killed the beast, Cates continued, all sails set. We've read the treatment, Crunch. Don't ask me how, Yaki. We've read it. This was the last jargon I understood between them. The rest was cryptographic showbizzing and Cates crunching that translated later to mean that Cates knew there was a script to support my project, wanted to deal, had a major talent agent named Sam who owed her a package, which means director and actors. She declared she was suggestible, that if Yaki thought I was due best numbers after the Oscar nominations, then he should name them now. Finally, Kate spread those amazing teeth at me and prophesied. You want to know my philosophy? It's simple. Like the man said, don't sweat deals, sweat box office. I report honestly that she was a vividly human female who, for as long as she was deal-making, was larger than life. She ingested those vegetables so fast she seemed to swell healthily. But then Yaki said the magic word somewhere in the inflection of the sentence, we'll get back. And Cates reverted to a normal-sized human being. She did not linger. Another cool grip on my wrist, a strong whiff of her muscular scent, a fetching, what luck to meet you at last, pause, Tip. And she was gone, only a few yards away to the buffet table, to huddle with other goods, but as far away as the horizon. I tried to ask Yaki, what? Yaki had changed, too, from partygoer to evacuee, with me as baggage. We were out of the marina so fast I had to hand my soda glass to the doorman, just as Yaki ordered his chauffeur to whisk us safely to his favorite fantasy restaurant. She was coming back, he explained mysteriously en route. We had to get out before she came back with her boys. I probed and demanded, but he wasn't substantive, until we'd settled at his favorite fantasy table and he'd sipped an extravagant glass of wine. "For Yaki," he began bluntly. "Too close, too close. I've got to get new legs. Too close." I protested this talk of dread. I said that I'd seen the subway movie posters in New York. Kate O'Cates. She was an inch-high name on 2 recent trashy top 10. I argued that she wanted to do our script. A wacky idea, re-terrorism, but with a happy twist. I had worked it up with Yaki a year before after we had simultaneously watched King Kong bi-coastally while holding open the line, so I could once again enjoy Yaki's adoration of that fabulous, fat, hairy boy, King Kong. "Kate wants to do our movie," I squeaked again as Yaki chewed another sip. "Killed the Beast, Yaki. If you are so truly trendy, you haven't seen KK, because it's black and white. The last line is the theme." "It was," said the producer, aghast at the gigantic corpse on 34th Street. "Beauty killed the Beast." "Forget it, tipster. Not us, not ours, not now, not. But, I tried, flailing. "Hasn't she got the money, the package, the muscle?" "She's got it," he said. "She's numbers up the up." "How much is up the up?" I asked. "Is that like Spielberg was? Or like Spielberg is?" "Spielberg's my age, so my envious eye makes him my only measurement." "She's the KO word," said Yaki. "What word I hear is her company's going over 20 mil on the 2 latest." I asked, "Net?" He didn't react because it was a dumb question. Hollywood publicizes in gross. It speaks in take-home pay. "Net, Yaki?" I gasped. "Net? 20 million for trash baskets?" Kate O'Cates was already major goods, and her best years were ahead of her. She was scrambling the code. Hot, pre-hot, hot. I managed a cynical, greedy question. "Not married to Spielberg or some such, is she?" "No," said Yaki. No. "She's indie." Then I achieved my breakthrough genius, the turn being that it was coming this way. The word net had lit my code-happy brain. Trying to ease Yaki's mood, I used the famous make-believe name. "Ahab," I said. "Yaki, she's my Ahab. And I'm what she wants as a navigator. We'll go fishing for Moby Dick together. I'll lose my demi-status. I'll be net rich. We'll be net rich." "Listen," thinks he is, returned Yaki, most unamused. "You don't know what you're saying. Stop thinking. This is business. I'm the agent. You want another? Do it. You want me? Then..." But net, I tried. Yaki then used a somber voice I had heard only once before, after a depressed client put Yaki on hold and botched a suicide. I had been on Yaki's hold that day, and he'd come back on the line with this bottomlessly rueful tone. What I'm describing is that Yaki was profoundly serious when he ordered me. "Let it go." I obeyed. I knew he was leaving the table and my confidence if I said any more. I looked at the menu, fretted that I'd crossed him. Yaki recovered gently. "We've got Cole Porter Kinescope tonight. He's heaven, heaven. You'll flip, and I'll let you think, too. Now, tell this beautiful boy," the waiter, "what we're sampling from his pretty kitchen." Gordon Liddy is my muse. Hollywood before the mast. 4. Now comes Ahab, along with love and money, the 3 things I didn't want in L.A. coming at me like a harpoon. Ahab was not at the hyped-up screening of a new Steven Spielberg movie about, what else? Steven Spielberg making movies. Also, Ahab was not at Yaki's fantasy country club, with its overlush but playable fantasy golf course. Yaki worships golf, though he cannot play, because he worships his best friend Billy Benn, who was away on Australian links that January. Where Ahab abided was at that promised most polite party at the marina, which was not a party but a charity benefit for the Current Fashion, L.A. street gang rehabilitation. I know I've also declared that Ahab is not, that he doesn't exist outside of paper, and neither does that fat, white fish, M. Dick. I'm not trying to trick you any more than I tricked me. This is a salty Hollywood yarn. And as the spectacular former swabby President Reagan has said often, it's all smoke and mirrors. Well, Ahab smokes naturally, and he lives in my looking glass. Here he comes, after some details. And the first trick is that this time around, he's very female. The marina was at Santa Monica Sunset. The crowd on the enclosed deck was as polite as charity can afford. So many goods that the Scabbers crew members looked intimidated away from their usual vandalism. Of note instantly was that it was a very A-list male gathering. You want names? You don't know the goods to hear them. That's the secret of their authority. Power makes privacy. The public studs included Michael, Bobby, Bruce, Tom, Jeff, Tom, Don, Kevin. I'm teasing. My idol, Tom Selleck, wasn't there. You think these studs of Hollywood street gangs don't party together? You're correct. This wasn't a party. It was a benefit, and the boys were present for self-benefit. You call it winter, but in Hollywood it's called Oscar season. The marina gathering to Vivaldi and Telemann strings might raise money for crack hooligans, but it was definitely a test for screen hooligans to see who was most polite enough now to risk nominating, maybe next year, and who this year could be trusted to open the envelopes on camera. The acceptable openers and winners have passed this test and moved on to other polite games, like endorsing presidents. Yaki hadn't told me. Well, the most polite had been a soft clue. But this was a showbiz, A-list, male, pre-hot, close-set tryout. The bonding was why I was unprepared for Cates. That's both names together, Mrs. Kate O'Cates. Her imaginative foes call her the K.O. word, and her hired friends say, "Yes, ma'am," instantly. She was no star or director. She was an independent producer, one of the goods. I was complaining to Yaki about the fit of my blazer out of the club pro shop and communicating how long I was not staying, 15 minutes, no more. And he was bartering. "Give me 24, tipster. Even a sitcom gets 24. When Kate stalked upon us and began fishing. "I'm lucky to find you at last, Mr. Payne," she said, taking my hand strongly to shake it cleanly. Correctly, she didn't finish the salutation and name herself. The goods assume you know them. If not, you're worthless. Also correctly, she used the first-person plural when she was doing business. "We've called Yaki about you several times," she said, "and he's told us you hide out in the Arctic, Hudson's Bay. No phone, no TV, no roads, no show." Flustered, I mumbled, "Call me Tip." Yaki propped a crutch against me, whispered her name to me like Dread O' Dread, and addressed Cates, sounding defense-minded. "I sent in a dog team, Cates. He's here to breakfast with Mom and play golf with me." "Oh, Yaki, I like your mysteries." Cates grinned very toothily, like an owner of all secrets. "I won't skip ahead," she said, "but I think we'll keep the tape machine rolling. Say, Late Night Network? I've never seen you in the glass, Mr. Payne, and it's good to see you first. The glass is cramped for tall, dark, and deep men." She gestured toward the Hollywood studs glowing behind her, all of them low on the horizon like cunning photo reductions of the sunset. "Don't you agree? It's a small mystery why it likes small and cute. You must know." This was a stealthily easy question, and this fool went for it. Jesting. Who'd want a big jester? As a reward, I didn't get a fish hook. I got her cool fingers on my wrist. "You don't wear a timepiece," said Cates, changing bearings. A pro's pro. "Is that because you don't care, like they say? Or do you have chronophobia, like my son?" He was a month late, and I'm still waiting for him to tell me to get off his case, same as his father did, behind schedule. She paused, as if she'd confessed. Her self-deprecation glowed like virtue. "But now you're here, and it's our time to talk, yes?" Detail, all details, chronophobia. Nice detail, Cates, and a tough clue. Cates was a detail person. I argue it was why I liked her so quickly. Sure, there was the detail that she was easy-looking, tall, fair, and deep. streaked hair, eyes any color contact lens she chooses, original long limbs, hired-on deltoid broad shoulders, and coiled legs. She was heavier than fashion or camera permits. Much later, she told me that in her college days, she'd tried screen acting, but that she was no good in the glass. She said that two children, divorce, and too much sport had made her, at 41, a pumped-up jockette. What you noticed first and only about that pretty face was the teeth. They were whalebone white, and they didn't quit. They just kept coming at you. She talked and fed omnivorously, and she was snacking from a heaped plate of fat California vegetables and tardy dip as she did business. Meanwhile, Yaki was still fending her off. We just stopped by on the way from the clubhouse. Some free giggles and home for Betty by. Get in 36 holes tomorrow if I can keep him from church. Sensational to see you, Kate. You look sensational, and when Tipster's back in town, we'll have lunch on your boat. Got one yet? Yaki yanked a brass button on my coat sleeve. Kate did not wait. This is now, Yaki. I want a meeting. She fixed dead ahead on me. The white teeth snapped on a carrot and me together. We admire your work, Crunch, and want to work with you, Crunch, you, Mr. Payne. I mumbled, please, call me Tip, please. We mean kill the beast, Kate continued, all sails set. We've read the treatment, Crunch. Don't ask me how. Yaki, we've read it. This was the last jargon I understood between them. The rest was cryptographic showbizzing and Kate's crunching that translated later to mean that Kate's knew there was a script to support my project, wanted to deal, had a major talent agent named Sam who owed her a package, which means director and actors. She declared she was suggestible, that if Yaki thought I was due best numbers after the Oscar nominations, then he should name them now. Finally, Kate spread those amazing teeth at me and prophesied. You want to know my philosophy? It's simple. Like the man said, don't sweat deals, sweat box office. I report honestly that she was a vividly human female who, for as long as she was deal-making, was larger than life. She ingested those vegetables so fast she seemed to swell healthily. But then Yaki said the magic word somewhere in the inflection of the sentence, we'll get back. And Kate's reverted to a normal-sized human being. She did not linger. Another cool grip on my wrist, a strong whiff of her muscular scent, a fetching, what luck to meet you at last, pause, Tip. And she was gone, only a few yards away to the buffet table, to huddle with other goods, but as far away as the horizon. I tried to ask Yaki, what? Yaki had changed, too, from partygoer to evacuee with me as baggage. We were out of the marina so fast I had to hand my soda glass to the doorman, just as Yaki ordered his chauffeur to whisk us safely to his favorite fantasy restaurant. She was coming back, he explained mysteriously en route. We had to get out before she came back with her boys. I probed and demanded, but he wasn't substantive, until we'd settled at his favorite fantasy table and he'd sipped an extravagant glass of wine. For Yaki, he began bluntly. Too close, too close. I've got to get new legs. Too close. I protested this talk of dread. I said that I'd seen the subway movie posters in New York. Kate, oh, Kate's. She was an inch-high name on two recent trashy top 10. I argued that she wanted to do our script. A wacky idea, re-terrorism, but with a happy twist. I had worked it up with Yaki a year before after we had simultaneously watched King Kong bi-coastally while holding open the line, so I could once again enjoy Yaki's adoration of that fabulous, fat, hairy boy, King Kong. Kate wants to do our movie, I squeaked again as Yaki chewed another sip. Killed the beast, Yaki. If you are so truly trendy, you haven't seen KK, because it's black and white. The last line is the theme. It was, said the producer, aghast at the gigantic corpse on 34th Street. Beauty killed the beast. Forget it, Tipster. Not us. Not ours. Not now. Not. But, I tried, flailing. Hasn't she got the money? The package? The muscle? She's got it, he said. She's numbers up the up. How much is up the up? I asked. Is that like Spielberg was? Or like Spielberg is? Spielberg's my age, so my envious eye makes him my only measurement. She's the KO word, said Yaki. What word I hear is her company's going over 20 mil on the two latest. I asked, net? He didn't react because it was a dumb question. Hollywood publicizes in gross. It speaks in take-home pay. Net, Yaki? I gasped. Net? 20 million for trash baskets? Cato Cates was already major goods, and her best years were ahead of her. She was scrambling the code. Hot, pre-hot, hot. I managed a cynical, greedy question. Not married to Spielberg or some such, is she? No, said Yaki. No, no. She's indie. Then I achieved my breakthrough genius, the turn being that it was coming this way. The word net had lit my code-happy brain. Trying to ease Yaki's mood, I used the famous make-believe name, Ahab. I said, Yaki, she's my Ahab. And I'm what she wants as a navigator. We'll go fishing for Moby Dick together. I'll lose my demi-status. I'll be net rich. We'll be net rich. Listen, thinks he is, returned Yaki, most unamused. You don't know what you're saying. Stop thinking. This is business. I'm the agent. You want another? Do it. You want me? Then? But net, I try. Yaki then used a somber voice. I had heard only once before, after a depressed client put Yaki on hold and botched a suicide. I had been on Yaki's hold that day, and he'd come back on the line with this bottomlessly rueful tone. What I'm describing is that Yaki was profoundly serious when he ordered me. Let it go. I obeyed. I knew he was leaving the table and my confidence if I said any more. I looked at the menu, fretted that I'd crossed him. Yaki recovered gently. We've got Cole Porter Kinescope tonight. He's heaven. Heaven, you'll flip, and I'll let you think, too. Now, tell this beautiful boy, the waiter, what we're sampling from his pretty kitchen. Gordon Liddy is my muse. Hollywood before the mast. 5. The next Ahab sighting of consequence was Monday off the 9th fairway at Yaki's Fantasy Country Club. It was my second round in 3 days with three of Yaki's buddies, and I was Hollywood weary. Too much fun and sleep, the sun relentless upon the smoggy January clouds. Yaki was bundled up tastefully from the midday 60 degrees and was riding his telephone-equipped cart alongside me, the prime minister of my every shot in between his chatting with other clients and his mom. Once more I knew that if I could only execute his advice, keep my head down, shoulders level, hands behind the ball, weight back, that I might once see 88 on my scorecard. Not that day. My stage fright for the tonight taping, in 6 hours, had returned to hook every tee shot. I went searching again in the trees for my ball. Yaki couldn't get his cart through the rough and called from the fairway, "It's there, left, way right," pointing with his field glass. I mucked around many soggy steps and realized there was another golfer, a woman, searching down the slope for her ball off the 18th fairway. It wasn't Kate O'Cates. It was one of her foursome. Kate spied me from the fairway, hesitated as if she weren't sure it was me, ha-ha, and when I waved in surprise, she swelled to larger-than-life size and waved back with, "There he blows," energy, hailing through the wind, "Good luck tonight, Tip. I'll be waiting." I wanted to amble down and flirt, but was afraid of Yaki. I'd already betrayed him in my thoughts and couldn't risk more until hidden opportunity. I did stare at those long legs. Kate stepped in my direction and I panicked, waving again and jumping back into the brush to land on my ball. Yaki, who'd been screened from all this treachery by the terrain, called, "Find it!" I plucked up my ball and walked out to drop for the two-stroke penalty. I got my shot off faster than KK climbs. The folly of all this is that Yaki had missed nothing, though he didn't tell me until much later. He knew Cates was stalking me. He knew that she was a member of his fantasy club, and that she'd been on the indoor tennis courts on Sunday, where I'd spotted her slaughtering a service. He also knew that she was playing ahead of us on Monday and that she wouldn't be so clumsy as to linger in the clubhouse bar where I, fool for love, hoped to find her after my round that day. In sum, Yaki knew that Cates knew that he forbade her. I knew none of this, nor so much more. Those whalebone white teeth and the elegant six-iron I glimpsed through the trees had convinced me, along with Hollywood greed and my own transcontinental libido, that Cates was for me. I mean, my make-believe girl, my love boat captain, Ahab. I'm mocking myself because I deserve it. She doesn't. I was so annoyed with Yaki by then, he had refused to speak more of Cates since Saturday night, that I dared bring her up in the locker room while he was advising me how to dress out of the pro shop for TV. I aimed to talk subtly, but it probably came out, "What's wrong with Cates? What are you, jealous? I'm not leaving you, Yaki. She's just a big girl who can take care of herself and maybe me, too. Let me try. At least let me try our script with her." Yaki's response is stone-written. "I'm sparing you. I'm not. More than that, sparing you. You want her, go do what you boys insist upon doing. I'm going to tell you what you're missing. She cheats, tipster." He tapped his field glass case. "I've seen it." I asked what he'd seen. He gestured toward the golf bags. "Cheats," he said. I blithered. "Cheats at golf? Are you nuts?" I added conveniently that this isn't golf, that Cates wants to do business, that he'd said so, and that this is Hollywood, where everybody cheats. I felt threatened enough by Yaki's frown to add the euphemism that always irritates him. I called his hometown Never Never Land. "Mind me," Yaki returned. "This is business, and no one cheats. Not me, not Mr. Moneybags, not you thinking boys. Cheating is what losers did. Their history. Snipped, erased, belly-upped. You don't cheat a close-up, and you don't cheat a deal. It's death, boy wonder. Cheating is death here. Never, never, nothing. Business like business, I know it. You mind me. Now and now." I protested, brilliantly blind insights, such as, "Yaki, are you saying that wealthy, successful deal-making Cato Cates cheats at golf, so therefore she's death? What about tennis?" I taunted. "Vodka tonics, taxes. And you say golf?" I gave away my cheating glimpse back at the ninth fairway then by saying that I'd seen her stroke a six-iron. She was a terrific jock. Why should she cheat at golf? It was too crazy. I laughed. I tried. "Cheats? How cheats? Kicks the ball? Fudges the scorecard? Skips a green?" "How she cheats is how you're going to find out," Yaki said. "You're the chatty Cathy amateur. Just remember, you missed it here first. And since I'm the big, bad blabber, I'm also saying that cheats at golf is cheats everywhere. Thing, time, mishigas forever. And ever, and ever." He rotated on his crutches and addressed my wardrobe. "Now then, what are we today? The charcoal slacks are tolerable for a college interview, and that hideous white shirt is you. It's you." Gordon Liddy is my muse. Hollywood Before the Mast. 6. The Tonight Show, with guest host Jay Leno sitting in for the elemental Mr. Johnny Carson, is coming right up, inside a plain soundstage in a plain parking lot in plain Burbank, a neighborhood of greater L.A. But first, some remarks about papermate Captain Ahab of the most unplain whaler, Pequot, out of New Bedford, Massachusetts. Sci-fi spy guy, Herman Melville, a black-and-white Puritan like Tip, wrote Moby Dick before he went bananas and moved back to New York City. I get a lot out of the book by just hanging around its scenes, replaying its wacky dialogue. Moby Dick is best understood as Melville's preliminary madness. He was uncommoning his sense in search of a big, air-breathing fish that is anything you want it to be, but that I read as Herman Melville himself swimming from what it is to be a sci-fi spy guy trapped in 1850 America. Herman was in pursuit of Herman. I'm trapped likewise a century later, so maybe Moby Dick is funny to me, first page to last, and a wordy illustration that though there's no escape, there's make-believe. The book is heavy on biblical chatter, classical idolatry, and whale talk. It's also very, very light on love stuff. It's a first-person fishing yarn that Ishmael, the narrator, makes stunning. Not because Ishmael's a smart guy, but because Captain Ahab is a tough guy. Not thinks he is. We're told Ahab's tall, straight, bronzed, robust, that he looks as if he's been cut away from a steak after a fire has failed to consume him. That he's got a livid white streak branded down his right side. The detail everyone knows best is that white peg leg of whalebone that Ahab plants on the quarterdeck like a pagan pedestal. The impression Ahab gives is raw fury with a mad motive. To kill the wild white animal that took his leg. But there's another detail, often overlooked. Ahab was playful, what trendy slang calls a player. He responded to fair weather with, quote, faint blossom of a look. He did that neat trick with St. Elmo's fire flashing down the harpoon to light him up like neon. Mad as he was, he still plied whaling waters to make a good catch. And even when he lost control and went after Moby Dick like only Ahab could, he played out his role as tough guy with ham-boned speeches that have a whiff of sci-fi spy glee, such as, there's a riddle might baffle all the lawyers backed by the ghosts of the whole line of judges. Like a hawk's beak, it pecks my brain. I'll solve it, though. My favorite Ahab monologue is during the final battle. It contains choice lines such as, I grin at thee, thou grinning whale. Oh, 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 thou grinning whale. But there'll be plenty of gulping soon. It's Ahab's playful hamboniness and grinning gulping I want you to fix upon. This is another tough clue about Kate's, like the one Yaki gave me about her cheating at golf. A none softer clue is Kate's whalebone white teeth. Watch them closely, snapping and grinning and confessing in gulps. Try to solve the riddle that might baffle all the lawyers backed up by the ghosts of the whole line of cruel judges. That evening I popped out of Yaki's limo in the Burbank parking lot, fixed upon surviving the Tonight Show. Yaki interrupted his phone call to say he'd pick me up right here when I was released. We'd go to a fantasy restaurant and await the tape-delayed network broadcast. His good luck speech was, don't even think about putting. Make nice and try to smile once for, he waved the receiver, reminding me I'd called home on the ride to Burbank, for your mom and mine. When you do national television, be aware that it's not fun like a circus or glamorous as it looks. It's a business. Nice people guide you to a windowless place that's traditionally called the green room. Modern TV has its own traditions. So, tonight's green room is silver mirrors balanced around the biggest looking glass of all, a discreet TV monitor that demonstrates its obsessive authority by being blank while awaiting the taping of tonight. Other nice people provide light snacks and leave you in soundless quiet. There's a clock face, and you watch it. There are other guests, too, and amateurs like Tip don't know what's polite to say in a strange room with strangers. The others are here for something. But there aren't name tags, and no one's standing by to do introductions, such as, yes, this is, famous head. The pros who do TV for a living often arrive with their buddies and chat quietly about unexplained events. If you want to be stonily alone, the niceness of the green room makes it possible to do so in a group, as only a lifeboat might provide. Jay Leno visited us momentarily like a crew coach, but I was too anxious to do more than avoid him. And he let me be. I did stare once at the major guest that night, but as soon as she came in the room, and it was a mistake. Faye Dunaway smiled back, said something human like, hi, and I was terrified by the time I returned a similar greeting. I failed to find saliva to say what Yaki had advised, that she and I had met once before at my gym in New York City, where I had helped her with a tricep machine. I wasn't frightened of her. She's nice, too. Though to have Bonnie, Milady de Winter, seated several feet away, being gorgeously real, is not for fickle hearts. I was frightened because this was indeed the wings of a timeless and boundless stage, and I knew then I was a watcher, not a watched, a crashed, not a crasher. To be exact, a nobody, nobody, nobody. Smoke is more than I was in those mirrors. The TV monitor popped bright on cue, and there was the theme music and Jay Leno doing a nice monologue about doing a nice monologue. I tried to pretend I was at home. The green room emptied like a lifeboat in reverse. The least shall be last. I kept visiting the men's room until another nice person came for me. Mr. Payne, she said. It's time now. I don't recall any sense but smell. The Tonight Show smells like industrial shampoo. Before I was out into those harmful lights and shaking nice hands. Who knows what was said? I never did watch it. You're in a time tunnel and it becomes teleportation and you're headed into the cosmos as photons forever. By my calculations, I'm in thin space by now, a year short of the nearest next star. I blinked and blinked to interstellar commuters. The nice audience applauded on cue. Faye Dunaway had left. Up close, Jay Leno's jaw is calming, as Dudley Do-Right's must be too. During the commercial break, Jay Leno, who is also nice, told me we only had N minutes to go, and he'd skip down the scripted Q&A, past my funny name, and funnier books to get to my movies. Then we were back on photons, and Jay Leno said, "Here's a clip from," and the monitor above the lights was showing 30 seconds of my trashy hit featuring the Olivier evil scene. Picture Prince Hamlet as the greatest pipe smoker of all time, Joseph Stalin. Up to this point, I had obeyed Yaki by making nice and smiling ones for our moms. I was not in control. I was in a script, and I answered about Moosehead Lake and ice fishing correctly. I must have said something TV because the audience laughed. You feel as if you're being cheered for making a give-me-putt. Still, I was holding on to Yaki's early instructions. Smart is a no-no. It sounds like taunting, and very smart means you're a dog-beater. Don't, tipster. Then there was 1 minute to go, according to the camera guy holding up one finger. You know trouble's coming. Here it is. Jay Leno departed from my script, though he kept to his own. He asked me, "What's next, Tip?" I froze. He tried, "Come on, you can tell us. We can keep a secret. There's only you and me here." Laughter. "You gonna land a flying saucer in Moscow?" Laughter. "And a good idea, Jay. You gonna try a love story?" De-icing, I returned that a love story was sci-fi at war with spying. So not for me. No laughter. Jay Leno, the complete professional, tried his wrap-up query. "Well, we've got spies too, Tip. And we hear you're going to kind of let King Kong win this time. A happy ending. Hey, am I right? Am I?" I was freezing up again, but not so much I didn't mutter affirmative. Jay Leno chuckled professionally and said, "Can't wait. We'll get him for a guest appearance. And if you'll put in a good word for us, but hey, tell him. Please say sir. We pay scale no matter what you weigh." The audience loved it, and to be fair to Jay Leno, he was not wrong to give away what Hollywood calls the high concept to kill the beast. He was reading from what his research people had given him. Guess who'd given it to them? Right, not Yaki. Tonight was behind me, and I got out of the soundstage and back to Burbank after some nice farewells. I was not clear-headed, too vain to do more than try to remember what I'd just done and left. So I hit the parking lot without noticing it was drizzling. The nearest limo glided toward me, and the chauffeur jumped out. I thought it was a Tonight limo, which I'd not needed, so I waved him off and looked for Yaki's car. The unknown chauffeur continued around to open the passenger door, and there was Kate's, snacking on veggies. "I couldn't wait to see you, Tip. I'm sure you'll be wonderful for 30 million other people," was her entrance line. She looked out from the cozy warmth of her vast German auto and showed those teeth. I backpedaled instinctively. She waved a cauliflower and got cute. In all the parking lots and all the world, I was just driving by and thought, why not this one? And then, me blinking in the rain, she got cuter. "I know you don't know what time it is, Munch. Want to go find a clock?" She was not dressed for scary wailing. She was in burnt earth colors, looking casual and scholarly, like a millionaire book lover. I proudly reported that I did not jump head first. I mumbled and reached for a miniature tomato on her plate. Then I declared that Yaki was picking me up and maybe we could meet later, maybe. I understand, said Kate's most maturely. I really do. You go home with what got you there. It's what makes you lucky. She laughed. I laughed. We laughed. And there was suddenly a place for us to visit called Giddiness. Still, I didn't go. I wanted Yaki. I wanted his debrief. I wanted his permission. Where is he? Kate asked. Of course she knew. He was where Yaki goes when betrayed. Away. I want to tell him how sorry I am for doing business the other night like that. I was out of line. You're his client, and I respect that. All this was intimate patter, you understand, because she was no longer using the royal we. She continued affectionately. It's this business tip. Sometimes when you don't move fast, you don't move. Do you understand? And forgive me? Easy charity is the way to this traitor's fortress heart. But not yet. I was holding to my latest rewrite, where I apologize to Yaki for Kate's, and Yaki says, forget it, Slyboots, and Kate's and Yaki make up, and we three go off to be friends and make movies. And then, nonetheless, my draft needed Yaki, and he was not showing up on cue to rescue Tip, who didn't want to be rescued. Oh, Yaki, if you were only less Yaki and more ordinarily a person who likes to repeat things until I get it too. But no, Yaki tells you his theme, and then he improvises until you surrender to his genius. Do you see him yet? Asked Kate. Is that his car over there? No, no. A few more minutes of eating vegetables with terrific dip and patter about golf, the weather, and my camp on Moosehead Lake. Anything but the business. Kate's was not going to scare me off with that again, though she might have guessed I was way past caring. More no Yaki. Finally, Kate's closed the distance. It's raining, Tip. You can wait in here. I don't, you know. I don't. Pause. Like men like you. And then she ham-bonily snapped those whalebone teeth on a radish and closed the door on us. Gordon Liddy is my muse. Hollywood Before the Mast. 7. We found neither a clock nor Yaki that night, nor for the next weeks that passed out of order. What happened was the love stuff that Herman Melville was very, very light on and I weigh in less at. It's why I'm telling this yarn balanced mostly on the preliminaries leading up to the sail to Catesport, and I'm skipping the ship-shaped routine once I got there. I did try to find Yaki many times, and the way that's done is you telephone him. He's not a drop-by fellow. I left messages with his associates, his service, and when I finally accepted that he wasn't talking to me, I left a written note with his mom. Dear Yaki, please forgive me, or call me, and yell. I need you, and... It went on in self-pity. Always easy when you're feeling righteous, because you think you're only half stubborn. I kept Kate's only half-informed about my Yaki search, because I was guilty both ways, betraying him and hiding his bizarre opinion of her. Happily, she was most busy pursuing her life with me, now a dependent. I was not in love at first, and we didn't bed down at first like celluloid robots. She had a modest leased manse in the hills, and I got my own room right away and kept it. I liked talk more than most anything intimate, and Kate's played along tenderly. She was smart and understood how confessions work. I provided autobiography in chapter form. She returned her text as if we were reading aloud, alternately. I'm new at the business, she told me. I'm not a Hollywood brat, and I didn't pass the bar exam and lever myself in that way. Century City mouthpiece takes over contracts. My marriage ended, and I drifted out here eventually. He got my babies because he did pass the bar and knows how court muscle works. Her ex-husband, O'Kates, was not a serious villain to Kate's. She'd kept his name. Hers was Linehan. But she didn't care to mention him much. Her father was dead, and her mother and large family were spread out back east in the professions. She'd been born in Baltimore, a Catholic family, and educated by the nuns until she broke away to go to Goucher College, then transferred to Princeton when the Ivy League wised up and went co-ed. Her law degree at Georgetown had been a slight return to good Catholic girl, but lawyer games and then marriage had undone that too. Washington was hot for girl law clerks in the early 70s, she said. You know, you were there. How it really went was, get one and forget one. I got married and forgot them. After that, there had been suburban baby-making, a miscarriage, and two healthy children in 5 years. There was also volunteering, hers with the Chesapeake Bay Environmental Group. Then came despair. I was 34 and looking at another 50 of it, with my mother's long jeans. You don't pass the bar and start again with them. You're a gopher. You're somebody's wife. You're a mommy who plays good tennis. You're a 4x4 caretaker. You're nobody. Do you understand that, Tip? Do you really? Nobody. I did understand. It's a routine story these anxious days, with too many first-raters out there not in play because their wives, mothers, simply not gone, gotten salesmen, like Tip. I also understood the trouble that followed the despair. She had an affair with one of the environmental radicals who wanted to depopulate Maryland's shoreline before the residents killed every living thing that wasn't human. He was a wonderful man and, pause, childish, like you, Tip, really. It's all right. When the no-nuke lobby got rolling after Three Mile Island, he jumped himself up front and traveled everywhere to testify. I loved his commitment. It wasn't like Vietnam again, which I'd missed. Big girls were not invited to that either. I started going with him. I hated being away and hated being home. I was still nobody, still his big girl and not me. But for a while I was working for something that... Do you know about that too, Tip? What they're trying to do with those nuclear plants, do you? I didn't argue back at this or other deep hooks in my brain. She was no nuke. I'm not. But to qualify my common sense with details about engineering was extraneous then and is now. She could weep about the environment. Ahab, I note speculatively, was an environmentalist too. He fished like a sport. He didn't exterminate. Today, he'd be a radical polarist patrolling Antarctica, that white desert of a Moby Dick. Kate's divorce ended her doubts, and the custody ended her debate. Kate's got to be somebody by court decree. By chance, she had met a group of filmmakers who were working for public television on environmental disasters. Kate's discovered that you could move from gopher to producer in show business without an exam, with smarts and speed. Once it starts, she said, you keep going, project to project, and you meet new people all the time who hire you for their work. I got to L.A. by agreeing to work. It's different, Tough, than New York. There's work if you're not an artist, but you've got to fight anyway, not to keep working, but to get a project better than the last. You know, it's tough everywhere if you're a woman, a big one, unmarried and hungry. I was that and got knocked down. Men, they like to knock, and I'm not a door. Don't laugh. I'm not a door. I got lucky the first time and thought about getting out. But to where? The business doesn't let you. There's always another project. Do you understand, Tip? If I'd set out to be my own company, I'd still be in Silver Spring, playing tennis. I remarked that she made her success sound like an accidental non-failure, or perhaps a mystical trick, a door that opens itself. She returned, no, it's just a business. But this is the first place I've been where I'm good at what I do. And I like that. I mean, they don't care what I was or what I've done. They don't care. That's everything to me. What I was and nobody. They don't even ask about it. You don't wear a watch, Tip. And they're like that. Like you. Chronophobic Tip then called Hollywood Never Never Land. Kate's corrected. Oh, Tip, it's not that way for me. It's everything. I remember her flashing those teeth as she emphasized what was stunningly the truth. I love it. I love them. They don't care. I could go on, but I've included the important details and enough for me to see again why I did fall in love soon after. I made believe she was a heroine with that magic word, pluck. I go to the movies like you, where pluck shines like the planets. I love pluck, and go all the way when it pertains to a handsome, intelligent woman who tried hard, lost hard, and fought back against many bad breaks and guys. Cates was always fighting hard, a Venus in orbit who was now eager to put her wondrous big shoulders into me, too, and I held on. The holding was excellent, I report vainly, and never better than after we traveled to a goods confab, where she'd done more business. Her production company's headquarters was in Century City, a development where Hollywood now actually abides, in tall glass palaces. Her polished desk was long stem rose adorned, and excellent for holding on between the thorns. We also held on in the limo, at home with the TV on, and once in a screening room so I could enjoy the game they play. I passed quickly from lustful to adoring to what I mentioned before, dependent. In her business, I was a non-player, a golf partner, supercargo. In brief, a nobody. My nobodyhood didn't bother me. I also had a minor status as a scriptwriter, since there was Killed the Beast to fuss with. I signed everything, which put me on her payroll. I did flinch when Cates told me that Yaki's agency had agreed to take points and release me, if that was what I wanted. I didn't want that, but I signed away Yaki, too. Cates was what I needed, I prophesied. Cates at sea, Cates at home. I was her mapmaker. She was my Ahab. Why didn't I tell her she was my Ahab? As Jay Leno says, hey, I did, kind of. I told her my Hollywood Before the Mast illustration and mentioned how Ahab and Moby Dick don't exist, but maybe they do. Ha ha. She wasn't impressed enough to comment. I let it drift. Maybe I did tell her she was my Ahab. I don't recall exactly. I was in love. That's my dumb explanation. In love. And you don't take notes in love. I note now that what works in Hollywood love scripts is a cute meeting, then a twist, then the long middle of the movie, where the lovers are angry with each other, then another twist, and a happy ending. Add special effects, and it's an adventure love story. It's a simple-minded formula, but don't mess, because, like love, it works. For Tip and Cates, there was an apparent departure from what works, but not really, if you're writing sad endings. There was the cute meeting, Marina Golf Tonight, the first twist, Yaki, then a month-long development, Unwedded Bliss, that seemed to lack anger. Then on cue arrived the second twist, which was disaster, and why the project died in production. Our special effect was madness. Gordon Liddy is my muse. Hollywood Before the Mast. 8. The Academy Award nominations were out, and I had one for Best Screenplay from Published Material, my screenplay of my book. I'm not telling you the title because you might stop renting the VCR tape, disenchanted by my blither. Cates and I celebrated by trying to eat a whole cheesecake. This is impossible, and quickly leads to a food fight. Later, I tried and tried to reach Yaki, since he was the one who'd gotten me the nomination. That failed. Yaki was ashore, waiting for me to wash up on the beach. When my head settled near Earth the next day, I mentioned to Cates that I needed to get out of L.A. for a rest. I asked her if she'd go back to Moosehead Lake with me to get cold, build fires, shun the phone, build more fires. She was eager for it, said she had to finish some details, that I should get ready for serious downhill at last. You can't begin by beginning, she instructed me. The expert trails are where you learn. I reserved our tickets, and when she couldn't make the date, I extravagantly bought open tickets. No, again, her projects would not dovetail. It was after Valentine's Day by then, and I had this rash idea that if I could get her alone, I might actually decide I didn't want to be alone anymore. I mean, second marriage, but not L.A. style, because that wouldn't work with Cates. Marriage should be business, Cates had said in her autobiographical presentations. What points do you get? This was a good query, and I thought that if we go to New England, I could try some Puritan magic and persuade her wifery was not skullduggery. The next Friday afternoon, Kate's hauled anchor suddenly when she arrived back in the limo to surprise me. We were headed to the airport, but not back east. We were Rocky Mountain bound to a fantasy resort that you achieve by changing planes at Denver and finally sitting in a four-wheel drive limo with other vacationers wowing at the upsetting moon-bright heights and a beefy cowboy driving one-handed whose vocabulary is, "Hey ya." Along with my fears of speed, drug, guns, and women is high places without wings. Yet another reason I like New England is that the mountains are midgets. Colorado, it's up. I stowed my anxiety. Kate's the jockette was ecstatic for the slopes come tomorrow. And after she placed two transcontinental calls, she tackled me. "Tip, no more business, I promise. We're free. For 3 days. Free." It wasn't the first day. That was me on my backside whining. Those trails were experts, all right. Hooligans, hoods, killers. Kate's tired of this by afternoon. And we had a good fight. Typical married stuff, you control, you boss, so that later we dined curtly and made up over a chocolate cake. It was the second day then, Sunday, and it happened strangely. I couldn't face the advanced slope again. At the lift, I said that I wanted to practice with the kids on the beginner trail. Kate smiled toothily. "Maybe you're right. You are awfully bruised." I added that I'd wait lunch on her and try death again that afternoon. After she'd gone on, I tumbled around sweatily, then sneaked onto the sun deck. Kate's was late getting down. I suppose she was soloing one more run. She was an hour late when I spotted one of the he-men from the killer trails and waved defensively. His name was Bo. He'd helped me face death the day before. Bo came over kindly to say, "Hey, yo, your wife okay now?" I was alarmed like a proper husband. Bo explained he'd seen Kate's being sick off the trail and had waved down the ski patrol to her. Bo added, "She okay now?" I raced to the deck phone, got an odd but not perilous report from the ski patrol, raced back to the sun deck, then panicked and tried the room. Kate's answered, "I'm coming right down. I'm sorry. You've caught me making some calls. I know I promised no more business. I'm sorry." I told her what I'd learned. Kate's had been seen vomiting off the trail. When the ski patrol had reached her, she had tossed them off and slalomed away. Kate's explained, "That's bull, blank. They were trying to hit on me. Big girl out alone. Knock on my door. The creeps." This was most un-Kate's talk. Not the door metaphor, but the bull bleep. She was never vulgar, a most polite tongue, and her sudden epithet and angry tone were like punches. It worried me about her, and then it angered me for her. I puffed myself up to call the ski patrol captain to complain about his creeps. What I learned this time poleaxed me. "No, sir, it's not that way," said the captain. I argued and accused. He was matter of fact. "I was there too, sir. We were worried. She was out of bounds, sick all over the snow. It's not my business, but my duty is. Your wife's either sick and not telling you, or she's just morning sick, sir." "Yes, sir, it was like that." Gordon Liddy is my muse. Hollywood Before the Mass. 9. I wish that I'd gone to her and said, "Kate's, whatever's happening, it's not terrible. I love you," and so forth. Actually, I approximated this. It's bad dialogue. It can't work. Even make-believe needs a car chase to rescue such bad dialogue. Mostly, I wish that what I'd discovered about Kate's was something normally scary, like pregnancy. Instead, I botched it worse than I want to recall. I did everything badly, beginning with a barrage. "Are you sick? Are you all right now? What happened up there?" I pestered her at lunch so hard that we didn't go back to skiing. And when she wouldn't answer, I pestered her in the lobby, in the elevator, in our room, until she fled the room, Colorado, and me. I've been left before. I've done plenty of leaving. But that way, that time, was wrong. The way she packed was wrong. She didn't flee. She transferred like a seaman to shore, in calm silence. I wanted hysteria, so I trod provocation, bringing up marriage, then asking if she was pregnant. I repeated pregnancy, marriage, pregnancy, wedding, pregnancy, family. She returned nothing, not even disgusted looks. Truth, there was a faint blossom on her cheeks that on another might have broken into a smile. And then she was gone Sunday by dark. Her last words were business. She showed those teeth and said, "I've had my calls transferred." A generous man might have tried a car chase, might have pursued her back to L.A. and negotiated apologies. I did call her, but not until I got back to Maine, and only because Moosehead Lake was noisy with the self-righteousness in my head. She refused to come to the phone. I abandoned Maine the next day and called her again from New York. More refusal. I tried a telegram, a garrulous letter, and then, after some rest, a diplomatic letter. Nothing. In due time, I got my letters back from her company, along with the junk mail that accumulates when Oscar the Harpoonist is possible. It was late March soon. By then, I had chickened out twice from getting on a plane back to L.A. and her. Why? A report that I was afraid of the pregnancy that I'd vainly assumed was the cause of our breakup. I was also afraid of Kate's, who I'd arrogantly assumed was angry with me for forcing myself into her life like a thoughtless whale. More grandly, I was afraid of Hollywood. It wasn't behaving like my neat illustration of whaling after all. It was a business that played fast by rules I didn't understand. I was afraid. Yaki had cut me off. Kate's had cut me off. The message I was not hearing was clear. "You're outside," thinks he's a tough guy. "Stay there." This coward obeyed. Is that it? If I said yes, you would hoot that you've been cheated. You have been. There's no way you could have solved this riddle with what you've been told, unless you've crossed someone like Kate and heard the diagnosis. It's a mind disease. It's not to be solved. When someone goes as far out of bounds as she did and has smart, speed, and wealth, this person is scrupulously in control all the time. Kate did not make mistakes. The vomiting and snow could have been morning sickness, or it could have been queasiness from her big breakfast. What found her out in the end was not her conduct, but mine. Yaki said it best in the locker room, that how she cheats is how I was going to find out. Remember, he said, "You're the chatty Kathy amateur." I wouldn't let Kate off with silent shrugs. My chatty prying finished us. She went back to her quarterdeck to net mightily and go ever more stupendously mad. This is how I learned the worst about Mrs. Kate O'Cates. Academy Award night. I was back up at Moosehead Lake, where I'd gone to hide and make-believe Cold War. I watched the ceremonies in dread. I figured that if I won, the goods who owned my picture would make the speech and I could find the nerve to return to Hollywood to claim my prize and maybe my big girl. If I didn't win, then I'd accept my fate. No suspense. I didn't win. Though I heard my name botched as Thomas Paine. I immediately climbed into another xenophobia game in the Mac. I also wept, which doesn't work when you're extinguishing alien blips. After midnight, the phone rang and I answered, assuming it was McCurr. It was Yaki, calling from his limo en route to an Oscar fantasy party. "Slyboots," he began, "what are we today?" I had been prepared for this for 3 months. I told him I was Genghis effing Khan, and I ate prisoners. Yaki returned, "Oh, my serious baby, we are calling attention to ourselves. We didn't win, did we?" "I did." The winner was another one of his clients. "So, sore puss, what can I do for you? Want to talk putting? It's time to worry about the Masters again." I got very serious and let him have it. My condemnation was furious hysteria and redundancy itself. Tonight, to Catesport, to Colorado, and his shunning. Yaki listened with careful sighs. When he was sure I was at a break, he announced that he had arrived at his mom's house and that we needed privacy. He called me back momentarily from his own rooms, asking, "Am I your friend, tipster?" When I answered that he was my deserting agent, He acquired his rueful tone, his suicide hotline tone, and told me to tuck in my hurt little paws while he settled down. Soon, while he viewed a muted copy of All About Eve to back up his sense of humor, he told me the truth about Kate. She suffered from bulimia. It's a mind disease, what is called an eating disorder. It means that after eating, you gag yourself until you throw up. Yaki was terse. He had not known in January. After my betrayal, he had made inquiries. In the business, Yaki had discovered, Kate's was a mansion around a locked room, around a hidden file, on a wiped disk. Yaki backtracked to pre-business. The trail was blank. He reached New York, where many secret files live and where Yaki has what sci-fi spy guys call deep cover sources. Still nothing. Too much nothing. Too blank a trail. I interrupted him many times. He chided me with, "Mind me," and "Stop thinking." When I tried to reject his argument, saying that bulimia was impossible, this was ridiculous. How could he be sure? Yaki talked tough. "It's the teeth, tipster. You heave up so much, the stomach acid stains the teeth. Kate has a moneybag dentist who does moneybag mouths. Monthly renovation. Dentists like him are in the business. He's also Mom's neighbor. He talks to Mom. Mom talks to me, okay? You can't cheat a close-up, tipster. I told you." Her whalebone white teeth, her snacking while dealing, her self-conscious bigness. I had watched and watched and seen nothing. There was much worse. Yaki got to it patiently, not skipping a step, because he wanted to help me, not bludgeon me. "I told you she cheats, tipster. Mishigas, mouthwash. That's old cheats. This is a new one. And believe me, I've seen strange, but not at the treetop. It's chills. It's between you and me and the screenplay. Just kidding. Checking your alert." He didn't wait. No deaf suspense required. He had found a guy who found a guy whom Kate had cheated once very early in her Hollywood career, at the threshold of the door she joked about, where the grappling is meanest. The source went unnamed because he was very sick, said Yaki, and not going to make it. Yaki was talking Hollywood now, a man who was in deep, deep cover while dying of a cruel disease. Yaki said he knew her, recognized her, and she canned him because of it. He says she's from Erie, Pennsylvania, a foster family, where he stayed a few months before he ran away. He says she was one of the older foster kids in the family, a little dictator who made all the decisions for the foster parents. Her real name is Monasterski, he says. I was confused. Erie? Yaki? Not Baltimore? I told Yaki to make sense. "Stop thinking," Yaki scolded. "My source said Erie. He said she locked him up in the smokehouse or something quaint when he got fresh with her. He was 11. She was 15. But he forgot about this until she canned him on the set. He claims now she denied it and then pretended to can him for theft. She blackballed him, he says. I had my office check. He was canned. Who knows why? My office tried City Hall in Erie to find the foster family he ran away from. The foster family's name was Monasterski. So our boy had gotten it wrong. It was a wrong tip, tipster. But close. Pa Monasterski is dead. Ma Monasterski is lost in a county home. But we got lucky at the nursing home and found a real Monasterski daughter named Babs. She's a mom herself now, a sweetheart. We chatted about movies. She's a great fan. Loves Amy Irving. That's the current Mrs. Spielberg. Babs wants to know when she's coming back. I was completely lost. Foster family, Monasterski, Erie, not Baltimore. Stop, stop, shouted Yaki. Dear Babs, that's Monasterski to you, does remember a big girl who stayed with her mom and dad after Babs had moved out. A big girl who stayed with the family over a year. Kathy DiPaolo, who went to work for the nuns in the convent. Yaki, you're scaring me. I have more, tipster. Do you want it now or... He paused, reacting to the action in All About Eve. When he came back on the line, he finished. Or at lunch in New York. No Moosehead for me. I don't go north of 57th Street. Say, day after tomorrow. Gordon Liddy is my muse. Hollywood before the mass. 10. That's sufficient. I don't have to prove this. Neither could Yackie, as it turned out. Kate's was that good. Nothing was true about what she claimed to be her name, family, hometown, college, law school, marriage, children, environmentalism, gopherhood. Kate said it all about herself when she said, nobody. It's just not possible to get to her who, where, when, how. It's all gone. The Foster family Monasterski clue didn't work out. Maybe Kathy DiPaolo, maybe anything. When I said that the goods power can buy privacy, I meant it. When Kate said about Hollywood, they don't care, I love them, they don't care, she meant it. Whoever Kate's is, she's solidly safe before the mast. I haven't tried to reach her again. I think sometimes that she might miss me, but then I think she's figured out that since I don't write her call, I was never to be trusted. She does cheat. I don't mean about Killed the Beast, what I suppose was her motive to close on me. Her company changed the title, the ending, the reason for its existence, and someday they might make it. But that's okay, because my idea was wrong-headed. No happy endings for King Kong. And even that original unhappy ending, with King Kong dead on 34th Street, that's half wrong. Beauty never killed the beast. The beast is still climbing, and beauty is still screaming. If they put my wrong-headedness in production, they'll pay off Yackie and me, probably accurately. Since Kate's must know, you can't cheat Yackie and get away. Don't try it, Kate's. Yackie's a tough guy, too. Kate cheated me. I was a close-up who didn't even get close, but she, the Fisher person's Fisher person, takes no chances. My darkest make-believe is that someday I'll risk visiting Yackie again in Never Never Land. Kate's will sail by. I won't be able to recognize her. She's wretched, retching madness. I can guess that the only connection between one Kate's and another is the quest in her. She put love's harpoon in me, and then, when I went belly up, she abandoned me because I'm just Tip Payne, the traveling salesman, not that famous white whale. Yes, here's Ahab the last time. No one knows where he came from either. No family, no friends, all business. Or truly why he was so angry. Moby Dick took his leg, so he was out to take Moby Dick. But why? What was before? Something big took Kate's teeth, so she's out to take it. But why? What was before? What made her so tough? Was it what Yackie says? Chills? Or was it a fire like the one that failed to consume Ahab? Branded him with white lightning down his side. Like a hawk's beak, it does peck my brain, but I'll never solve it. Herman Melville is history. Ahab and Moby Dick are paper. And Kate's, she's out there doing business, prophesying. I grin at thee, thou grinning whale. Oh, 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 thou grinning whale. But there'll be plenty of gulping soon. Gordon Liddy is My Muse. A novel by John Calvin Batchelor. Hollywood Before the Mast. Read by John Batchelor. The End.